Washington Post Live's This is Climate Tipping Point Summit is presented by 3M and Ecolab.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hello and welcome back, everyone. Welcome to Washington Post Live if you're just tuning in. I'm Bina Venkatraman. I am a columnist here at the Post and I write on the future. And I'm very pleased today to welcome Raj Shah, who is the president of the Rockefeller Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bina. Thanks for having me.
So we have a little bit of time to talk about a lot and a very big problem. You led the USAID in a former life. You're now leading one of the world's largest foundations. You literally wrote the book on big bets, and by which you have meant large transformative innovation solutions that can solve large-scale problems and really make traction. So here we are today talking about the climate crisis, one of the most urgent crises we face. What would you say is the top big bet we should be making on climate change?
Well, it's great to be with you, and thanks for your exceptional reporting on climate and its impacts around the world, and certainly at home. And I think the biggest message I'd have for listeners today is that although the climate crisis is extraordinary, although the early observations of how fast we're crossing these irreversible tipping points makes it feel like solving climate change is somewhat impossible, it is actually possible to win the fight against global climate change. And it is possible to prevent 1.4 billion people from going hungry because climate change takes away their agricultural productivity. It is possible to prevent future pandemics that are going to be far more likely if we allow climate change to proceed unchecked. However, to win the fight, we have to change the mindset of what we're doing. And we can't really go after incremental solutions only in wealthy economies. Instead, we have to actually understand that this is a global problem, that 75% of future emissions will come from 81 countries, excluding China, that are today housing 3.5 billion people who are living in relative energy poverty. And if they power their future and their prosperity with diesel and coal, which is what's happening today, no matter what we do in wealthy economies, the world will not succeed in the fight against climate change. So our big bet is to build an alliance that can finance the rollout of new renewable technology for energy production and energy infrastructure throughout the developing and emerging world, and to do that with a long time horizon and a sense of absolute commitment.
How do we get there with respect to climate financing? Because we know that the oil industry is still reaping trillions in profits, that coal is still on an upward trajectory in China and elsewhere in Asia. Climate finance sounds like a great bet. How do we make it commensurate with the kind of investment that can be put back into the fossil fuel infrastructure we have?
Well, that's a great question because, you know, we live in an economy that's a global economy north of $100 trillion. In that context, we have, by most estimates of what's required, is about $4 trillion of annual investment for the next 20 years. So that's 4-ish percent of the global economy. Of that $4 trillion, about $2.5 trillion is what's needed in the 81 countries I mentioned, the energy-poor economies, to build infrastructure that allows people to rise up while also allowing us to tamp down global emissions. So the question is, where do we get $2.5 trillion a year? And that's a great, great question. Next week, world leaders, the heads of the multilateral banks will all come together and debate whether we should continue business as usual with a Bretton Woods post-World War II financial architecture that was built to rebuild Western Europe and frankly is only been reformed incrementally since then, or whether we should fundamentally rethink that infrastructure so we can get hundreds of billions of dollars of additional investment out of the multilateral institutions we already have. The Rockefeller Foundation has partnered with the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Motley, and many, many other global world leaders, William Ruto from Kenya and elsewhere, to propose a set of reforms we think can generate hundreds of billions of dollars of additional concessional capital. We've worked with the UAE to launch their effort called Altera, which is a new sovereign wealth platform designed to invest in climate finance. UAE, like many other Middle Eastern countries, have benefited from windfall profits in oil and gas, and they should be plowing a lot more of that capital into concessional capital that can finance the infrastructure needs of the developing world.
From a global political standpoint, coming out of Dubai and COP28, it seems at least that there's now consensus, or there's an agreement that came out of that, that we need to transition away from fossil fuels, which was at least some measure of progress. How would you comparatively assess where we are with those multilateral institutions and those financiers in changing the paradigm there?
Yeah. Well, I'd say the general political statement that we need to transition away from fossil fuels is welcome, is necessary, is long overdue, and is not yet backed up by a set of meaningful instruments that would provide the financing to do so. One such instrument the Rockefeller team helped create with our partners, and it's called the Global Energy Alliance for People and Planet. And we put in $500 million, the Bezos Earth Fund, the IKEA Foundation matched those commitments, then we raised about $10 billion in investment commitments on top of that. That platform has allowed us to launch about 22 projects in just over a dozen countries that will bring energy access for the first time to 40 million people that live in energy poverty using renewable infrastructure, solar mini grids tied to batteries with distribution systems and smart meters in eastern Congo that'll reach hundreds of thousands of people, partnerships with companies like Tata Power in India to build out 10,000 of these rural mini grids to reach 25 million people in India and transform their lives in a clean and efficient way. Those are good initial investments, but we need to get from hundreds of millions to trillions. And that's going to take a recommitment from political leaders. We're hoping to see some new commitments at the G7 this year. It's going to take more domestic investment from emerging economies. We're hoping to see in the G20 this year, the large emerging economies commit to investing more of their public finance in that space. And frankly, it's going to take an honest conversation about how to wipe out the debts of primarily African economies, where more than almost 40 economies are experiencing a post-COVID debt crisis. So as we're sitting here talking about investing in renewable energy, they're spending 60, 70 cents on the public dollar repaying debt because interest rates have tripled in those settings, and that cripples any real investment to make the kinds of public investments you need to power an energy transition.
You and I share a passion for trying to harness the best of science and technology to solve public problems, but in this case, I'm hearing you talk a lot about the financial instruments and the political will. How much can we rely on technology to make game-changing leaps in terms of the climate crisis versus these other sort of brass tacks?
Well, this whole thing is only possible because of technological innovations. You know, so when Rockefeller started innovating these small solar mini-grids for communities where people, frankly, were consuming less than a couple hundred kilowatt hours of energy per capita per year, which is not enough power to have a light bulb and a small home appliance operating for the course of a year. I mean, these are folks trapped in poverty because they don't have access to energy and electricity. These systems would provide power at $1, $1.20 a kilowatt hour 10 years ago. But thanks to innovation, smart meters from Spark Meter here in DC, batteries from China and Korea and elsewhere around the world, and including lithium-ion batteries, and new technologies that allow you to manage these systems remotely using artificial intelligence, we now see the cost down to around 15 to 18 cents a kilowatt hour, at which price point it is a more efficient way to provide productive electricity to many, many, many communities. So we think you can reach 1 billion people around the world with those types of technologies alone. That's not going to be enough. We also need real technology innovation in nuclear fission and fusion in order to provide better baseload power to economies. We need better grids and smart grid technologies. We're partnering with technology companies in the U.S. and partners around the world to help build digital twins of energy infrastructure in developing countries so you can create a viable model for how you would power an energy transition that's technically sophisticated. So there's a ton of opportunity for technology and innovation. And without that innovation, frankly, all the financing in the world wouldn't wouldn't really have anywhere to go, you know, to make a difference. So it's a precondition to our capacity to be successful.
Do you also worry about the flip side of that, though? We know that generative AI, for example, is going to have a huge amount of energy demands, and how that changes the landscape for what we need to do to actually accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad you asked that. This is the thing people, I think, are just starting to realize. The theme has generally been, if you look at the NDCs or even from the Paris Agreement, the underlying modeling and assumptions have been that wealthy countries will plateau their energy demand, and because of energy efficiency, will meet their needs through largely efficiency gains, and developing countries will grow dramatically their energy demand. Now everybody knows quite clearly that that's not the case. Energy demand is going to skyrocket everywhere. And frankly, to meet that demand in a clean, efficient way that is just and equitable, that pulls billions of people out of poverty, you have to do this in a much more cooperative manner on a global basis. You need much more public investment, and you need the kinds of public-private partnerships that through our Global Energy Alliance we're trying to seed in economies around the world.
So going into COP29, and with what you just said about the need for more global coordination and cooperation than we've ever seen before to achieve this scale of change, how concerned are you? There are a lot of geopolitical headwinds in the world right now, the falling back of democracy, two wars, the debt crisis, which you mentioned, that faces so many developing nations. How realistic is it to think about coordination geopolitically to achieve these aims?
Well, I actually think it's quite realistic, and here's why. This isn't, you know, and I say this running a foundation, this isn't something that is solved by charitable endeavor. This is a core strategic priority for every head of state that I have spoken to. You know, that they know they need to provide renewable and always on productive power at lower price points to their economies. They know that they can't move people out of poverty without doing so. And they know that the technology frontier makes things possible today that go well beyond coal and diesel, even though, as we speak, there are 6,500 coal plants that are going to produce 200 billion tons of carbon emissions over the course of their life that, frankly, need to be retired and replaced. And so, to me, it's a self-interest project for every national leader on the planet. And the question is, to be successful, we have to cooperate. You know, it's very unlikely that a modest-sized African country is going to have access to the battery supply chain on a global basis without some pooled procurement. So we've launched a battery energy supply coalition that allows countries to come together and acquire batteries together for their grids so they can take more intermittent power. In Kenya alone, they have the largest East African wind project is sitting at 16-17% utilization. It's called Lake Turkana Wind, because the grid can't take intermittent power, and they can't solve that problem without global cooperation. So we just need to change the mindset, and it's not about charity. It's not about trying to get wealthy countries to just give money to less wealthy countries. It's about coming together and creating a better future for all of us.
I going off script here, because when you say it's in the self-interest of these countries, there's almost an argument that an autocrat who's going to stay in power politically in these countries has more of a self-interest than some of our democratic political leaders. Do you have confidence in democracies to see this as a self-interest?
It's a great honest question, you know. And look, if you are a democratically elected leader, you have to serve your constituents. I mean, I'm telling you, every leader I sit with wants to know, can I provide, what am I going to do to change the rural livelihoods in India or in Malawi or in Zambia? As we speak, we're rolling out 1,000 of these solar mini grids in Zambia. The Zambian government, for political reasons, is investing in local farmers to help them build small businesses, to take that energy demand, to professionalize their post-harvest management of crops and markets, and to improve their incomes. And what we've seen in, we now serve a few million people with these mini grids. What we've seen when we study the impact is small businesses drive demand. Those small businesses, whether it's a seamstress in northern India or a farmer in Zambia, Once they start using electricity to improve their livelihoods, they're creating jobs, creating income, and moving their communities out of poverty. And you, if you do it fast enough on a politically relevant cycle, that's what leaders want to see. They almost never say, hey, is this an important project? Everyone knows it's an important project. They want to know, can you deliver results before the next election? And that's where our mindset has to change. It's why when we get together next week for the World Bank IMF annual meetings, we can't just have conversations about incremental reforms that 7 years from now will give us 6% more capacity in a system that's been constrained for the last 50, 60 years. We have to be bolder than that, and we have to move with much, much greater urgency.
Well, I'm ready for the field trip to Zambia. I'm in. So we have a question from
we'll
the audience.
We'll go together.
In a year or two, whenever they'll be ready for results. So we have a question from the audience. It's about the next generation and climate change. This is from Brian Kuhn from Maryland. And he wants to know, how do you see the role of education in addressing the climate crisis and preparing young people for the green jobs of tomorrow? And how can we support climate education on a federal level?
Well, you know, first I think climate education should be a part of everyone's education, right? If you, like when I have three kids, they find subjects like physics and chemistry interesting sometimes and less interesting sometimes. But when you say, hey, this is actually the key to unlocking, you know, a new form of electrification that can transform the planet and end poverty, all of a sudden they're like super interested in wanting to learn more, as opposed to just sort of learning the basics without that applied mindset. So I just think overall we have to see this as the greatest opportunity we have to inspire people to learn a set of disciplines that are going to be part of saving our planet and ending poverty simultaneously. And what could be more inspiring or more important than that task? It reminds me a little bit of when we had the moonshot and when Kennedy set the goal of going to the moon. We didn't know how to build the rocket. We didn't know half of the underlying physics of how to do that project. But the goal itself mobilized a different sense of inspired commitment to learning and development. And we need that kind of a mindset in our education system across the board.
Well, you raise a great point with that, because there was an imagination that it captured the imagination to say, let's put a man on the moon and let's put a person on the moon and have them walk on the moon. Can you paint a picture for us of what a greener century would look like? What should we be imagining?
I can. It's so exciting. You could imagine that for the first time, a billion people on this planet that live in extreme absolute poverty, where girls collect firewood and don't go to school and are often abused in the cover of dark, are moving themselves out of poverty through access to solar and wind and local microgrids that are economically and commercially viable in their own right and power small businesses that create rural livelihoods that lift up the poorest people on the planet. I can imagine countries expanding their school meal programs at scale to make sure that no kid on this planet goes hungry, and then tying the public procurement of those school meals to sustainable, renewable, regenerative agriculture, so we begin to change the way we produce food, and in the sector that is the second biggest production of carbon, shifts from producing carbon to sequestering carbon. I can imagine a financial infrastructure where we're selling green bonds and doing innovative financial instruments, and our smartest bankers in the world are using all that wizardry and skill, instead of just purely making money, to make money and make lots of it, but do it in a way that allows us to make the single most important upfront investments now to build infrastructure that will scale these technologies and save our planet. And I think the greatest chance we have for inclusive growth and development, and I say this as someone who helped in a small way contribute to the negotiations around the Sustainable Development Goals, and now see us falling behind year after year in lifting people out of poverty, out of hunger, out of ill health. The single greatest opportunity we have to turn that trend around and achieve those goals is to see the climate transition as the biggest opportunity humanity's had to make a difference in our economy, for our people, and for our planet. And that's what I think is at stake.
Thank you so much for sharing such a fascinating green dream and for this conversation. Unfortunately, we're out of time. It's been great to have you here.
Thank you, Vina. It's great to be with you.
The following segment was produced and paid for by a Washington Post Live event sponsor. The Washington Post newsroom was not involved in the production of this content.
Gail, it's great to see you again, because it's been about a year since you and I sat here to have this conversation about the difference that corporations like yours can make when it comes to climate change. And you did a recent survey, which I think is really interesting, just a couple months ago, 2024 State of Science Insights survey, found that 81% of people around the world said they think climate change is one of the biggest threats to humanity. So let's talk about the multi-pronged approach that 3M has really come up with to begin to tackle this issue.
Yeah, thanks, and thanks, Tori, for the comments. There are actually 85,000 people around the world who contributed to 3M's results. And another piece of that data from that survey was that 85% of the people responding from all around the world told us that they thought science was key to making a difference to addressing climate change. So as a science-based company, which Tori nicely pointed out, you know, we're really focused around science and everything we do in sustainability, whether it's science for circular, science for climate, or science for communities and what we're doing. So many things that can be done. That's why we focus our portfolio. We do things on our own footprint, we do things with our portfolio, and we use our technology platforms that are based on science to really make a difference, whether it's those greenhouse gas or those greenhouse films that Tori mentioned, that they started as things that you're probably all carrying right now in cell phones and monitors to make those energy efficient, the way they manage light. That same light technology is now used in different films that help improve the energy efficiency of greenhouses by dividing the light so that there's one spectrum of light that's helping the plants grow better, and another segment of light that's helping drive solar energy to run them in the off time when the solar's not working. It's also the same similar baseline technology to what we use to make the world's first self-powered communications headphones. So yes, it can be solar outside, but even ambient light in the room can be used. So this is for our safety products that help workers all around the world. Just one example. So science in so many different ways, that I think that's the key, and we've heard great things so far this morning. I love Michael Cohen's talk of S-curves, and there's a lot that can be done with science, and there's a lot of progress already being made. It's a matter of adopting and maybe talking with your neighbors about solar panels.
Well, let's dig into some details. When you look at these amazing solutions that you're coming up with, which ones do you think that 3M has created could have the greatest impact if you were able to really apply them around the world?
Yeah, you know, John Podesta told us this morning that the largest piece of the United States greenhouse gas emission is the transportation industry. Closely linked to that is the electric grid. Both of these are really important areas for 3M to be contributing more, whether it's about modernizing the electric grid. Worldwide, that's usually what people point to first, is the electric grid, especially as we electrify transportation. We see that we have solutions that help make it smarter using data science and artificial intelligence to detect signals and predict failure before it happens, ways to make them more resilient against various types of climate and weather issues, and ways to help build renewable energy on the grid. So grid and electrification of the transportation industry. We heard a lot about that today.
I wanted to talk about the grid, though, a little bit,
okay,
because there's a very cool thing you have come up with. Aluminum composite reinforced overhead transmission lines have twice the capacity of a typical steel line. So tell us about those and the difference those can make.
Yeah, well, they're huge. In fact, they're having twice that capacity and a fraction of the weight.
Right.
Okay, so this means that when you're going into, I'll give you a couple of examples. You can keep the existing towers, so you're not disrupting the nature, you're not disrupting the communities. Now, that's inconvenient in most parts of the United States. In central Mumbai, that's people's lives. And so people have homes that are right at the base of power towers. So when Mumbai wanted to increase the electrification in the city, because more and more people were getting electricity into their homes, they were able to use these we got to work on the name maybe. The aluminum composite conductors, right, that because of being aluminum rather than conventional materials, they carry more and they have lighter weight. So they were able to greatly add to the city's electrical capacity. Another example would be in South America, in the port where the transmission lines are going across the entrance to the port. This is a major cargo port where the number of containers that a ship could carry was actually limited by how the transmission lines dipped. So now, in addition to being able to carry more, now the less weight means that they could add actually an additional carrier to every initial carrier piece, right, to every ship that's going in and out of that harbor. And so the impact of that is beyond the electrification. It's really in the efficiency of the transportation from ships. So, I mean, we work on a lot of really different things that, I love that the folks before us, whether it's Sublime or LanzaTech, they were talking about they work on sexy things. These are really sexy things, you know? The way these things can change are pretty profound.
And those are the kind of organizations, companies that you partner with, right?
Collaboration, if you've picked up things today, sustainability is fundamentally reliant on collaboration, because each of us brings our own expertise, whether it's profound expertise in working with large organizations like the Pentagon, or scientific expertise, or this brilliant ideas that are coming from startups and new ways of looking at things. In addition to, you know, some of the folks that in natural pozzolans to help reduce the carbon footprint of concrete, or sorbent on a roll is a technology that we brought forward. It uses our filtration technology. You may think of Filtrete or N95 respirators. Oversimplification, but that same type of filtration technology can now be used in partnership with a small company, in this case Svante, who we work with to help capture carbon dioxide out of the air. And then things like what the previous speakers were talking about from LanzaTech, they can do things with the carbon dioxide and the carbon that's already above the ground. You know, so the world is really changing, and I love the concepts also discussed previously from Sublime about there are so many things that can be done. It's a matter of tapping into it and figuring out how to do things.
Well, you're also taking your science and your innovations and you're applying them to yourself, right? To your own 3M carbon footprint, because you have a very ambitious goal. You hope to be carbon neutral by 2050. So talk about that. How's that going?
Yeah. So I think there were some questions earlier about how do you know that companies are doing it and how do you have confidence in that? We're very serious about our science. We have a lot of fun with it, but we're very serious about it. And we need to have the math and the path and that plan according to the time. When are the investments going to be made? What is the carbon impact? How do we go about doing this? So we require ourselves to do that. And it's been quite a successful approach. Since 2019, we developed our latest math path and plan. And we've reduced our absolute emissions more than 43%. Now, we're not new at this. Since 2002, we've reduced our scope 1 and scope 2 absolute emissions more than 80%. We have big goals. There's a lot more to be done. But we have that math path and the plan identified to do that. It's about things that we do to identify how we make our products. What processes do we use? What raw materials do we use? What facilities do we use? How do we source the electricity? We currently have more than 56% of all our global electricity comes from renewable energy, and we're working to raise that even more. So there's multi-pronged approach, and this is just talking about carbon, because we're here talking about climate, but we do the same for water, for plastics, and for any other public goal that we put out there.
You know, as you look at the progress that you have made, and then you look at the just around the world and in industry, at corporations in general, what gives you hope? What are you optimistic?
Well, Kathleen and I talked in the break room. I am optimistic. Fundamentally, I'm a scientist. My parents were both school teachers. I'm a gardener. You know, people don't do these things if they're not optimistic. And I think one of the things that has struck me is in how the conversation has changed in the last decade or so. You know, I've been to a number of the UN climate conferences and a number of conversations like this, and there's so much more to be done, but there's so many solutions out there, and you see people moving on it. I loved the S-curve that Michael Cohen showed earlier today, showing how technologies get adopted. We can see those signals today, whether it's electric vehicles or renewable energy or so many things that we've seen examples of in the presentations. We're coming up those technology S-curves. There are tremendous challenges ahead, but we can see the ways to do it. And I loved the point about it's all about people, and how do you influence your those that you know, because what people see becomes normal and becomes more comfortable.
Well, I thought it was interesting in the last panel, Matt Rogers said you have to make it easy.
Yes.
You and I were talking about that, about it's not that the technology isn't there, it's the will. It's the
easy
will.
Easy and aspirational.
Yeah.
I think... He was also talking about the Tesla Roadster. I mean, you know, that became an aspirational vehicle, and then the Model S, and then others from there, to the point where now we're much more affordable, and every car maker, I think, around the world has some sort of offering in this space. And I don't know how that would have been done if you didn't make it easy and aspirational. So I think those are the keys, and I think we're getting there. I really see so many examples.
So what do you think? As we leave here today, those making the change, like those at 3M, but people in the audience and our viewers at home, what do we need to remain focused on to reach the target that we need to?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to, so much of what we know is available to us. So I think we need to act with urgency. We need to base it on sound science. Need to understand what the trade-offs are. We need to collaborate together. And I think the thing that has maybe been missing in the last several years in some of the conversation is really about bringing people along. We talked about environmental justice. How do we make sure everyone's coming forward? And how do we win the hearts and minds of people to really want to make this change? So I think there's a lot that we can be done, and I'd ask you to join us.
Gail Schuler, Senior Vice President and Chief Sustainability Officer at 3M. Thank you so much for the fascinating conversation.
And now, back to Washington Post Live.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Shannon Osaka. I'm the Climate Zeitgeist Reporter at the Washington Post. And today, I'm so excited to be joined by this panel of innovators and entrepreneurs to explain kind of the moment that we're at in terms of emerging climate technology. So we have Dr. Jennifer Holmgren, the CEO of LanzaTech, Matt Rogers, the co-founder and CEO of Mill, and Dr. Leah Ellis, the co-founder and CEO of Sublime Systems. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. So I want to start by asking each of you to briefly explain your company's technologies. And Jennifer, I want to start with you. You are the author or co-author of 50 U.S. patents. You have more than 30 scientific publications and a PhD in chemistry. So I'm very excited to hear your explanation here. Can you talk about the process of recycling carbon that LanzaTech is doing, and what are some of the uses that are available now?
So what LanzaTech does is makes beer. We take waste carbon emissions like CO2, and we have a bacteria that eats them and converts them to ethanol. So it's basically like making beer, except that instead of using sugar, we use gases. So we've developed the technology to do gas fermentation. What you're seeing there are pictures of our gas fermentation refinery in Belgium at the ArcelorMittal steel mill. We take gas from that steel mill that would normally go out as CO2, we convert it to ethanol. Now, the world does not need that much ethanol because ethanol, I mean, we're going to EVs, right? However, ethanol can be converted to ethylene. Ethylene can be converted to sustainable aviation fuel. Ethylene is the largest commodity chemical we use in the petrochemical industry today. Most of the things you use and have in your home come from ethylene. Polyester, the polyester in these pants, these H&M Move pants, was going to be a greenhouse gas in a plant in China. And instead of being CO2 and particulate emissions, it's polyester. We've made running shoes. We've made all sorts of things from waste.
Awesome. And we've all heard a lot about carbon capture and storage and thinking about that moving of CO2. Can you talk about just the decision here between carbon capture and storage versus this more recycling utilization plan?
Well, first of all, we need it all. I'm sure you would agree. We need sequestration. We need to take carbon either out of the air or out of effluent and put it in the ground. However, unless we use carbon, waste carbon, we are always going to be condemned to having a fossil economy. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. Everything we use comes from fossil carbon. And so the only way out of that is to use carbon that's already above ground. And that's been our focus. We believe there's enough carbon above ground, whether it's locked in trash, biomass, or an industrial waste, mm-hmm. and we can turn that into everything. There's enough carbon above ground to make everything we need.
And Matt, I want to continue with you on this theme of kind of changing outputs into inputs, because that's part of what you're doing, but in a very consumer-focused way. Can you talk us through what your solution is for food waste?
Yeah, so I've been making consumer products for most of my life. I've made things like the iPod, the iPhone, and Nest. And I didn't know how bad the food waste problem was. Food waste is like 10% of our emissions. We spend like 2% of GDP on food waste, which is like a mind-blowing stat. 2% of GDP on food waste. So of all the things we have to solve, this feels like the easiest and dumbest climate problem we have. Can we just keep food out of trash? So that's what we're doing. We're making it really easy to recycle food at home, where most food waste comes from. Mm-hmm. So we made this really cool new kitchen bin. It's an appliance you use in your kitchen every day. It's beautiful. It's easy to use. You put all the food you don't eat in it, and it dries and grinds the food into what looks like coffee grounds, but actually is dehydrated food. It's super nutrient rich. It's a resource that then we get back to farms to feed soil, feed animals, or you could use in your garden to grow more crops.
And I think that some companies have tried this type of approach before and have struggled in terms of just the economics, getting it to scale. Can you talk to us a bit about the challenges there and how you see a path forward?
The key actually is with food recycling is getting the water out. Mm-hmm. And what's made it challenging for large-scale municipal composting today is running those trucks to our homes every week, because food gets pretty gross. If anyone's tried composting at home, they've probably dealt with the fruit flies or the icky, drippy bags. So we've tried to make this as easy as possible. By taking the water out, it also means we don't need to come pick it up every week. Mm. And because this stuff is dry, it takes weeks to fill up. So instead of picking up the trash every week, we're coming maybe once a month to come pick it up. So it's a totally different economic structure. Makes things much cheaper. Also, this stuff is a resource, as opposed to today where we pay money as a society to dump things in landfill. This is a resource that actually is valuable for farmers.
Right. And Leah, in previous interviews, you had this very interesting quote, which you said that what Sublime is developing is kind of like the electric vehicle of cement. Talk to us about what that means and build up that analogy.
Yeah, so today cement is made in massive fossil-fueled kilns, so very high temperatures. It releases tons of CO2, so for each ton of today's Portland cement results in 1 ton of CO2 emissions, and this adds up to 8% of global CO2 emissions because cement is the biggest man-made industry in the world. We use almost 4 billion tons of cement. So Sublime Systems is trying to fix this problem by reinventing the process by which we make cement, so replacing the high temperature, the fossil fuels, and the combustion with an ambient temperature electrochemical approach for breaking down minerals to make ultimately the same reactive cement. So it's by avoiding combustion and fossil fuels, you can actually get a more efficient and energy efficient path. And this is important because our energy consumption is growing and we're deploying renewables even more fast than ever before, but we're still not making a dent. And so we have to do things in a more energy efficient way and in a smarter way as we continue to evolve.
And you talked in the video about just how much building we're going to be doing in the coming 30 years. We're building a whole renewable energy economy. We're also developing. Many countries are developing. I mean, how important is it that we get this green cement to scale, and how fast can we do that?
Yeah, there's a window of opportunity here where we have to move really quickly because, of course, we need to get to net zero to mitigate the worst of climate change. But we've also got a growing and urbanizing population, and we have to build homes. I mean, cement, just like fossil fuels, is not something you can go cold turkey on. You can't replace it with other things right away. Mm-hmm. And so you really have to reinvent the process. And we also have a window of time right now where there will be many greenfield cement plants built in India, in Africa, in the developing world, and also here in the US. Our cement making infrastructure has an average age of over 50 years old. So we have to move really quickly to deploy innovations to prevent 50 to 100 years of emissions, because these big capital heavy assets are meant to last a very long time.
I want to stay on this topic of scale up for a little bit. And you know, both Jennifer and Leia, I mean, you have both received funding from DOE. Climate tech is very capital intensive. I mean, that's one of the challenges that we're facing with deployment, is all of the capital that we have to put in up front in order to get these results down the line. What is the role of government assistance in this space and those government awards, and what is the balance there between public and private funding? Jennifer, let's start with you.
Sure. We call it crossing the valley of death, building demos and then building commercial plants. And the first of a kind is by the time you risk adjust it, it's usually too expensive to purchase. And that's why loan guarantees and grants for the government help. What you're referring to, Shannon, is we just got a grant to take CO2 emissions and convert them to ethylene at a petrochemical complex with our partner, Technip. It's $200 million, and that's 50% of the cost. So the government helps you by giving you a grant that pays for half of the plant, then all of a sudden you're able to either get a loan for the other half or you're able to raise cash for it, because the economics get so much better. The problem is we're still focused on IRRs, we're still focused on how you get returns. And a first plant that costs, you know, $500 million, which is what these are, they're refineries, right? You know, you need to still compete with others who are building infrastructure, right? And an infrastructure fund needs the IRR to be right. So this partnership between government and private allows you to make the economics to drive the private investment.
And Leah, how do you see this journey through the valley of death and coming out on the other side?
I think to build on what Jennifer just said, like, this is so important to have funding from the government for industrial hard tech sectors, because what Jennifer and I are doing is at massive scale. So you may have something that works at pilot scale, like our process for making cement, 250 tons a year. It works continuously. We've been doing it all year. But we have to get to 1 million ton per year if we want to compete on cost and if we also want to have an impact at scale. So I like to say there's the awkward teenage years of innovation where, you know, you're a startup, you're cute, everything you do is wonderful, it's impossible to make mistakes. And then, you know, there's adulthood of a company where you're making money and you're useful. But then Sublime Systems is at the awkward teenage years where, you know, your technology is very expensive and it's no longer cute and it's not yet useful. And venture capitalists don't know what to do with this, because they're used to making big bucks on software, which take, you know, 3 years, you know, you're writing code, you're just paying for laptops. And this is a totally different ballgame. So you need to be patient. You need to be slow. You can't mess up. You cannot mess up a big plant like the one that Jennifer did. It's not like software where you like delete a semicolon and then it works, you know? Like, so there really has to be this catalytic funding, and it's the role of government to make sure that we're making the right long-term choices. So the invisible hand of capitalism makes great short-term choices, like optimizing on a quarter-by-quarter basis, but you know, the consequences of climate change are for the next generation. So McKinsey and Bloomberg have calculated that, you know, we need trillions to mitigate the worst of climate change through technology and adaptation, but there's quadrillions you have to spend if you blow past that. And it's really the government's job to keep this train on the rails.
Jen, if I could jump in, like, we've actually seen this work before, right? Like the story of solar of the last 30 years and the success we've had with driving the cost of renewables down exists because of the government. I think, like, rewinding the clock back 20 years, there were similar conversations of, oh, like, renewables will never be at cost parity. And that was the entire point of Sunshot and all the government stimulus and matching dollars that then eventually drove IRRs to where they need to be, where now solar is scaling and you don't need as much government support.
Right. I wanted to also turn to you, Matt, because you've sort of straddled the sort of software world and the more physical object, tangible world. And I'm curious, like, what are the differences in terms of dealing with waste versus when you're dealing with software?
Oh, I mean, like, it's all a human problem. Mm. At the end of the day, like, it's really about behavior change.
Yeah.
And one of the lessons I learned back in my days at Apple and that we took with us to Nest is that actually you could change people's behavior and get people to do the right thing if you make it really easy. And it's one of the things that technology industry has done really well over the decades. Like, everyone's addicted to their smartphones, unfortunately. But what if we could use that technology and design for good? And that's what we did at Nest. We made a really addictive product. You would turn the dial and look for the green leaf, and people would save energy. And I think, you know, I've been out of Nest many years now, but probably at the point now it's at 150 billion kilowatt hours saved. That's like planetary scale energy savings, like enough to power the grid for the entire planet for a week.
Amazing.
Yep, not too bad for a thermostat.
Yeah.
And like similarly, could we use that technology and design and behavior change for waste?
Yeah.
Right, today, the easiest thing to do in your kitchen is put that food waste down the sink or in the trash. And if we can make it easy, addictive, fun to do the right thing, people will actually do it.
How are you thinking about the addictive part? Because when I think about putting trash in the trash can, I don't necessarily think of that as an addictive process.
Oh, you gotta make it fun and engaging. And one of the things I took from my days at Google is this thing called the toothbrush test. Like, great products that are kind of at the top of mind are things you use at least as much as a toothbrush, yeah, twice a day at least. Everyone uses toothbrushes twice a day. So what we're seeing with our mill bins at home is that people are stepping on the pedal and opening up just to look and see what's happening inside. It feels like magic. They're like, all those, you know, like in my house, like stews and things that we're putting in, you come in, you're looking at it the next morning, and you're like, it turned into coffee grounds. How is this possible? And like that triggers something in our minds where we want to tell our family, tell our friends, to get everyone involved.
I'm curious, for each of you, what do you see as the biggest non-technological hurdle in your work? You're all, you know, very smart scientists, et cetera, but what is it? Is it consumer adoption? Is it all of the infrastructural hurdles? What do you see as the main problem?
Well, from my perspective, to be honest, we all like to say no. there is power in no. And when you're doing something new, it seems everybody wants to tell you what is wrong with it. It's not the perfect solution. It's not the unicorn flying through the sky. And so they'll tell you everything that's wrong. And nobody ever sits down and says, well, the problem is that what we're doing right now is wrong. What they want to tell you is what's wrong with your solution. And that prevents progress. That prevents movement in government, right? Government is looking for safety nets, you know, fall in love with an idea like hydrogen, but what about all the singles that get you to that home run? And because everybody's looking at the bad things, we focus on the long-term things, the magical solution, and so we make no progress on the things that take effort and time. And so really, we have to say yes, okay, this isn't the perfect solution, but then again, our alternative is using fossil carbon for the rest of our time on Earth. And so we have to get to the power of yes, not the power of no. We have to prevent the no's. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing that I would say is to all of you, every single person in this room can be an ally to people developing new technology. Mm-hmm. When you're developing new technology, we need the allies who will help you say yes, who will help you get to the yes. Mm-hmm. That's what we need.
Overcoming that status quo bias that we are all afflicted by. Yeah.
Yeah. Similarly, I think like changing incumbent industries that have been around for 200 years is challenging. And in our space, waste is a local issue. Mm-hmm. So like, there's action at the federal government to move things forward, but actually like, waste is a city by city, town by town issue. And like, that is that's a long journey to then go, you know, and change every town and every city's municipal infrastructure. And then do that across the globe. But that's what we have to do. I mean, there are just not a lot of 10% climate problems out there. So, I mean, it's worth putting the time and effort to do it.
Yeah.
And Leah, what about for you?
Yeah, I mean, of course, time and money are the obvious hurdles. I'd say that it's difficult to compete on cost on day one when you are competing with industries that have had 200 years of optimization. And so it goes back to this awkward teenage point. I think you really need a village to get through that point. And you need people to say, I want this when it's ready, and people to sign up for it. Otherwise, you know, the venture capitalists, and you know, they need to see that there is a future for this, that people care. And sometimes it's not even so much putting your money down as saying, I want this. And I imagine a lot of people here own concrete or build homes or do renovations, and you'd be surprised like how much it matters when you just ask the question, like, is there a low carbon way of doing this? Because that gets heard and those voices get amplified. And I think everybody here owns cement, whether they think they do or not. So public procurement in the US is responsible for 60% of cement consumption. So if the public sector and the public doesn't realize that this is important, realize that this is a huge lever, 8% of global CO2 emissions, and cement is one of the cheapest materials out there. It's $150 a ton, approximately 1 ton of CO2 per ton of cement. So just think of, you know, the impact in terms of dollars per ton of CO2 emissions. So, you know, just ask. I think everybody should know cement is, you know, one of those things that's so invisible. And I think making it visible is part of my challenge because nobody thinks about cement. There's been no cement innovation. It's, you know, my background is in lithium ion batteries. Everybody knows that because they've experienced that innovation over the past 20 years. So part of the challenge is bringing the invisible and making it visible. Like, you know, CO2 is invisible, and so we can't see it. But, you know, Jennifer just made a pair of pants out of CO2. Like, that's amazing.
It's not sexy, but a lot of the work we have to do on climate change is these kind of overlooked and unsexy things. Right. And like, you know, like, there's not a lot of glory in trash or cement, but we have to do this work. It's really important.
I don't know, people call this unsexy, but I think it is.
It is.
Freaking cool. We're all sexy on this day.
Yeah. Okay, there you go. But actually, you know, that visibility is important, and this is actually why we use products, right? Everybody knows that fossils are used for making power and for making chemicals and fuels. Nobody knows that all of the materials we use are coming from fossil carbon. And so raising visibility to where does my stuff come from? We call this carbon smart consumer. Consumer who knows where the carbon in their product comes from and asks.
Yeah. And now you're getting into part of my job, which is how to make these unsexy things more interesting, more narratively compelling. One of the things we're sort of dancing around is the question of the green premium and how sustainable technologies are costing more, whether it's in the form of cement, maybe whether it's in the form of, you know, your home waste basket. I mean, can you talk about how we can get over that hurdle, get through that awkward teenage stage and to the point where those premiums are lower?
Yeah, it's all about achieving scale. So like you got to start somewhere. And my experience has always been you always can start premium, and it's hard to go up. It's easy to go down. So finding the tastemakers for your industry, and in our case, the folks who are willing to pay a little bit extra to have a better experience in their kitchen, to not have fruit flies in their kitchen and not to take out the trash every day. Like, there are people out there that'll do that, that then get the flywheel spinning so that we could get to where we are now with EVs and solar. Again, like, I was an early adopter of EVs years ago, and buying a Tesla Roadster for $125,000 felt crazy at the time, but now you can get an EV for $30,000. And at the time, we thought that would be impossible. But with those early tastemakers and early adopters, with government subsidies, you eventually start getting the flywheel going at the scale.
Yeah. Jennifer, how do you think about that in terms of the premium?
Exactly the same way. The more you build, the cheaper each unit gets, right? The first unit has a lot of belts and suspenders, more expensive. But it goes down in size, it goes down in cost. The more you build, the cheaper it gets, the more you build. But you have to also be very grateful to the Roadster guy, to the early adopters, right? Because they're the ones that buy it at the premium initially and then are able to drive it down. But you also have to remember that the polyester in this is not what drives the cost. And so we're able to work with partners, early adopters like H&M, who say, I'll absorb the cost to help you get to scale.
Yeah, similarly with the green premium, I mean, cement is a fraction of the total installed cost of concrete, which is 80% labor. And then concrete is a very small part of the cost of a building, which is mostly HVAC and windows. So when you roll it up and you look at the product that you buy, the premium can sometimes be very small for the impact that you're making. And then in a macroeconomic level, there's, you know, getting to scale, of course, often erases the premium. And so you can do that the way the US government's doing, by subsidizing the demo stage of these most promising innovations, like Sublime, like LanzaJet, and making sure these first commercial modules are fully validated, so then you can explode to full scale once that's done. The other way is the way Europe's doing it, where they're putting a price on carbon, and many corporations are doing this too. And they're not just doing it because they're altruistic. They want to de-risk their supply chain. They've seen this, like, you know, in Europe, they want to make sure that they're pricing in these negative externalities before they get surprised. And then the other thing about the green premium, and going back to what Jennifer said, is you can often surprise yourself by saying, like, what if? So, you know, I'm a lithium-ion battery chemist, and, you know, when I started, got into this, we never thought that lithium-ion batteries could be below $100 a kilowatt hour. And I don't think that was driven down by subsidies. That was just Elon being like, bring this back cheaper, like make it, you know, squeezing it down and asking people for the impossible. I think oftentimes there is a way when you set yourself an unrealistic goal and then just push, because you know it's urgent and important, you will find a way.
Thank you. And this has been a wonderful conversation. Jennifer, Matt, Leah, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.